This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. The crew of Leafs fans departing Boston Pizza City Place here after causing a ruckus earlier on, but providing
a good
some
ruckus.
It was a good ruckus.
It was one of those ruckuses where you know, we actually enjoyed the ruckus.
Sure, they caused a good ruckus. You caused a negative ruckus by going into the women's washroom by mistake.
But there's no need to bring that up for a second time, Drew. It was clearly a mistake. I'm sick. I'm not thinking clearly. I'm hungry, so let's just move on here.
This segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight, Daryl Lennox at Rumors. The 7:15 p.m. show is sold out. There are still tickets available for the 10 p.m. show tonight, so you can get those tickets quickly before they sell out at rumorscomedyclub.com, or head down to Rumors or give them a call at 204-488-4520. Gentlemen, an interesting article in ESPN by our friend Craig Custance. He's been on the show numerous times. It's under the paywall of ESPN Insider, so unfortunately can't tweet that out to you. But it talks about Dustin Byfuglien and the appeal in trading for Dustin Byfuglien, and the appeal for the teams that may be interested in acquiring a player of Dustin Byfuglien's talent. And, you know, in the article, Craig Custance talks to Chris Versteeg. And, of course, Versteeg played with Byfuglien on the cup-winning team for the Blackhawks back in 2009-2010. And he talks about, Versteeg talks about how, you know, he doesn't understand a lot of the criticism that surrounds Byfuglien. And he says that this is a guy who's a dynamic player who can be a game-changer for a team in the NHL.
Yeah, and that's why Chris Versteeg's a player and Stan Bowman's a general manager. Because there's a player perspective and there's a management perspective. And I don't think anybody who sees Dustin Byfuglien play disagrees with, you know, Chris Versteeg's assessment of how talented he is. That's not, and he goes on later to say, you know, he probably gets talented because they see, gets criticized because they see the potential, and that's all true. But Dustin Byfuglien, I mean, we know what Dustin Byfuglien is, I think, in Winnipeg more so than other places. Obviously, you see him on a game-to-game basis. Nobody questions his talent level. They question his ability to defend. We've talked about that ad nauseum, really. And in terms of his trade value, I guess, Drew, you probably want to talk about what Custance, you know, put out there in terms of what he thought or what some people thought they might be able to get for him.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, Craig Custance, in the course of the article, mentions that he was talking to a general manager. And the general manager, and he doesn't name the general manager, obviously, speculates that, you know, Dustin Byfuglien on the trade market could be worth, you know, a first-round pick and an A-level prospect.
And I don't think that, I think that Dustin Byfuglien is a possibility of getting traded. I think the Jets would deal him under the right circumstances for the right deal. I don't think they'd absolutely have to trade him, so I don't think it's certainly a desperation move by any means. I don't see it really being for a first rounder, though. I see it being for more, and I wrote about this last year on LegalCurve.com, either a top six forward or two younger players who are almost ready to step into the game. So, you know, a defenseman and a forward kind of thing. Guys who are ready to go. A year maybe away, but from really establishing themselves. But a first round pick from a team conceivably could be a guy that helps you 3-4 years down the road. And I don't think they want to trade Dustin Byfuglien for that being the piece of the package. I mean, it doesn't hurt, obviously, to get one. I just don't think that's the kind of thing that they'd be looking at if they do deal him. But if you're dealing him, you know, are you dealing him as a forward or are you dealing him as a defenseman? And are you dealing him from, you know, a position of strength or weakness? And I think the thing about Byfuglien with fans is he plays three great games. Don't trade him. He's this good. And he plays three bad games and trade him. But then he has no value, you know. So it goes both ways. You have to have a little bit more of an even keel. And that's why, obviously, general managers have to have that objectivity when they're making a move. So I think they're listening. And I think a team like Vancouver, for example, why would they not be trying to get their paws all over Dustin Byfuglien to play beside Ryan Kesler?
Sure. Well, they're a team that's struggling offensively, a team that could use a little more size, and a team that has seen Dustin Byfuglien at his best and what he can do to an opponent.
Right. So the question becomes, do the Vancouver Canucks want to trade a first-round pick, which will, let's say for the sake of argument, is in between 15 and 20, okay? Or 15 and 20, is that fair?
Yeah, probably.
Okay. So is Vancouver willing to trade, let's just call it the 20th overall pick, and Bo Horvat or Hunter Shinkaruk for Dustin Byfuglien? And I think that is really the question here.
I'm
just saying, like, we're talking about this article by Craig Custance, and he quotes a GM saying that that's what he believes. Now, you disagreed. I'm just saying that if you want to actually illustrate that with a real live example, that's what you're talking about here. You're talking about Hunter Shinkaruk and a first round pick for Dustin Byfuglien. Now, would Mike Gillis make that trade with Chevy? Would Chevy make that trade? What's Chevy looking for if he's wanting to trade Dustin Byfuglien? I think, Richie,
there's cap ramifications.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because really, if you think about really maybe the reasons, the motivation for Kevin Cheveldayoff to trade Dustin Byfuglien, getting $10 million off the books for next year and the year after has a huge impact. I think you'd agree, because now you have extra money to spend on either a forward or a top four defenseman.
No, that's also true, but I think, like, if I'm just thinking up deals, I'm thinking up, you know, you want to be able to get a guy who can play on your roster right away. So if you're looking at Vancouver, for example, you'd want to get a defenseman back, you know, somebody like Dan Hamhuis, like a one-for-one kind of thing, which is then the money issue is negated a bit because they're making, you know, close to the same amount of money. I think that would be one that makes sense for both teams, because if you have Edler and Garrison and you can move Tanev up into your top four and you have Bjeksen, I don't love that four if they move a guy like that, but you help your offense and you can move Byfuglien back to defense. So there's all that flexibility that goes along with it. But I think you take money into account and you take position. Like, the thing about Byfuglien is it's not like one of these pending UFAs where only contenders are going to go for him. Like, a team that's not great can still go for Byfuglien if they see value there. So that's why Chevy's in the driver's seat with this one.
Sure, you'd mentioned the Dale Talon down in Florida, obviously. Good, very familiar with Byfuglien from their Chicago days together. And in the article, Craig Custance speculates he thinks that Boston potentially could be a fit for Dustin Byfuglien.
Mentions him as a defenseman on that team. I just don't see that defensively conscious team wanting a guy like that on the back end on a day-to-day basis, unless they think because of that culture in the room, the defensive culture and the fact they've been, you know, down the road of the Stanley Cup Finals, once winning, once losing, that they'd be able to sell him on it. Because he just doesn't put enough attention to detail on defense. Now, when he's on offense, it's less of an issue, of course.
I've said this before. I don't believe that the Jets should trade Dustin Byfuglien. That's my own personal opinion. And I think if you get a room... perfect example is the three people at this table. I think, you know, Richie might say, you know, they should trade him because of what they could get for him. I believe that now that he has shown that he can play forward for an extended period of time, it's only six games, but it's still, I guess, a larger sample size. They have to stick with him. But, you know, Richie mentioned that he doesn't see Dustin Byfuglien playing defense on the Boston Bruins. I agree with that. And I am starting to think that, let's say that there's a half a dozen teams to 10 teams that are seriously interested in Dustin Byfuglien before the trade deadline, because we've got the roster freeze coming up before the Olympics. You'd have to think that a majority of those teams are thinking about using him the same way Paul Maurice is using him right now. That's a forward on the third or second line, and then as a defenseman on the power play. Because I don't think it really changes team to team.
I agree with that. I would deal him if it was the right trade, but I certainly wouldn't if it wasn't the right trade. There's no pressure to deal him. You have two more years of the contract on him. And 5.2 people are in. Craig Custon says in the article, 5.2, probably too much to play for the role he's playing on forward. I was of that belief a couple years ago. And, you know, a 4 or 5 year deal at $5 million if he's playing third line or second line right wing and maybe not performing.
The Devils are playing Ryan Clough $5 million to play on their third line.
The thing. So, I mean, on a long-term deal, I don't have an issue. I think it's an issue. Now they've played these years on defense, and they've seen that probably won't work, maybe on a long-term basis. Then they have 2 years left. You can play them on forward. It's all about how the cap looks in terms of your whole team. And you have Trouba now basically getting paid very little.
Sure.
In context of his NHL, that you can move a guy up and you can average out the money.
Exactly right. And if Josh Morrissey, when he's ready, there'd be another guy coming in at a very low salary.
Right, but you want to make sure that Morrissey, and I've only seen him play very little, so I really don't know anything about Josh Morrissey.
I'm not saying he's going
to
be
here. But the point is, you want to be able to have the depth in place that these guys really can, you know, not everybody's going to be Jacob Trouba, but fans certainly have to understand
that. They can come in a more minor role and ease their way into bigger minutes.
I think it's reasonable to also say that Josh Morrissey probably won't come in and be as dominant as Jacob Trouba has. There are just so few players. That's what makes Jacob Trouba so special. Not to say that Josh Morrissey can't crack the lineup next year, but to expect him to play the type of minutes and produce the way Trouba has, I think is a little bit unrealistic.
Exactly right. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll discuss the signings in and around the NHL over the past week.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Minutes before 2 p.m. this afternoon here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. Number of signings in and around the NHL earlier this week. The two biggest ones happened in San Jose yesterday as the Sharks re-signed both Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau to three-year contracts. Joe Thornton getting 3 years, $20.25 million, an average annual value salary cap hit of $6.75 million, a slight pay cut in terms of his previous cap hit, which was $7 million. Patrick Marleau gets a similar deal, 3 years, $20 million, average annual value of $6.67 million, down from his previous cap hit of $6.9 million. Gentlemen, your thoughts on both contracts? Pretty reasonable for the Sharks?
Richie, I think the no-brainer really comes into play here. And we had David Pollock of the San Jose Mercury News on the midweek show on Wednesday. We asked him about the pending UFAs, Thornton, mm-hmm. Marleau, and Danny Boyle. Dan Boyle obviously hasn't signed yet. There's that deal's a little bit different, and he has had some concussion problems this year. But as far as Marleau and Thornton go, Thornton's leading the league in assists. Marleau is having an unbelievable year. Mm-hmm. The thing to me that which is unbelievable is both of these guys came into the league in 1998. Drafted both in the first round.
1-2.
They're still 34 years old. Like, these guys have possibly 5-6 years left of productive hockey, and they were signed to the three-year deals, and I think that's really telling because, to me, these contract extensions are about winning. The San Jose Sharks are in a good position to go on a Stanley Cup run, not only this year, but over the course of the next several years. You could argue in the next 3 or 4 years. They've got a mixture of youth and veteran leadership. When you talk about Patrick Marleau, he's only played for one team. So the contracts seem reasonable. And we all know that these guys could have arguably gotten more on the free agent market. They just make sense. Doug Wilson did a good job here.
Yeah, these are pretty, you know, Drew, they take a little bit of a pay cut, respectively. Nothing significant. They're both making great money. They're in a three-year term. They both have unfinished business in San Jose. They should have already probably won a cup. They haven't. They have another couple chances. And if they don't, that'll affect their legacy. And they know that. And they want to make sure they get it done here. They're happy in San Jose. The team's spending to the cap. They like playing for a Doug Wilson-run organization, which it's hard not to. And they like living up in Northern California, and the lifestyle is pretty sweet. And the attention you get is good, but not overbearing. And so it's one of those things where it was a matter of time before it got done. It gets done, and they throw it out there in the press. But we won't even talk about it in a week, so... It was assumed it was going to get done, Drew. And Thornton's kind of done a string of these three-year deals here. So both sides, it's just a kind of old-fashioned way they used to do it. You know, there's no crazy, long, drawn-out negotiation. These guys both, the GM knew he wanted to keep them, the players knew they wanted to stay, and they both came to a reasonable term and a reasonable number.
Just going to quickly say, I thought it was interesting. Joe Thornton's agent is, of course, his brother John Thornton, right?
There you go.
And I thought it was interesting that he said that they had a more time to work on their deal, and because of the unfortunate passing of Don Baisley, he was Marleau's previous agent. He wasn't quite caught up in where the negotiations were at, so I thought it was really telling that Joe Thornton and his brother, his agent, waited so that Patrick Marleau could get to that level and they could get those deals done together. Those guys have seen what Doug Wilson has done with locking up Logan Couture, Joe Pavelski, Mark Edward Vlasic.
That's right.
He's locked up those guys. They know where the direction of the San Jose Sharks is clear. There's a clear core. You throw in Hurdle and you can throw in other guys. Boyle, we assume, is going to re-sign. Maybe not, but we assume because of the fact that he has a good relationship with the team. He's been there for a while. But I think it's important that those guys decided, okay, let's wait and we'll both sign these contracts together. And then again, Dan Boyle is the next one who has to sign.
Another contract signing from earlier this week, and this one, this actually happened last Saturday as we got off air. This one makes a little less sense to me than the previous San Jose Sharks ones. Steve Mason signs in Philadelphia, 3 years, $12.3 million. It's a salary cap hit of $4.1 million. He was making $1.5 million this year on a one-year contract. You know, from Steve Mason's perspective, I understand it. from Philly's perspective, I don't understand the urgency to sign Steve Mason to this deal for those terms.
And that's not the first time, certainly won't be the last time, that you don't understand why Philly's done something. They've always been pretty aggressive in their contract signings. Matt Reed is an example. I mean, Ilya Brizgalov is an example. Do you want to go on and on? I mean, we could go on and on. So Mason was in the bargaining position in terms of his performance for the most part this year, the fact they need a goalie, and the fact that they didn't really want to pay big, big money for a goaltender. So $4.1 million for Steve Mason, who's proven basically he's had a season and a half, a little more than that, of absolute success as a number one netminder, I think is ridiculous. You wouldn't have gotten more than that in I think on the open market, frankly, and if that on the open market, I don't think he gets any more than that. I don't think he gets that on the open market.
I don't think he gets 3 years.
Yeah, I just don't think that Paul Holmgren, the way he does things, is a bit odd. And
reactionary?
Yeah, sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't. I don't quite understand, frankly. He wasn't even going to be a UFA after this deal. He wasn't going to get 4.1 in arbitration, as far as I'm concerned. And So if you you have another year of control. So if I'm Paul Holmgren, I would say, okay, I take him to arbitration or sign a one-year deal again, see what he's like. If he has another good season, then you can maybe look at signing him for a longer term. But he likes to be aggressive. He doesn't like to wait for those things. He likes to sign away those RFA years and give him a little bit more money and take his gambles. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't.
I know, and I'm going to stick up a little bit here for Steve Mason. Not that you guys aren't sticking up for him. Maybe
no, I don't blame I don't blame Mason in the least bit. If I'm Steve Mason, I sign this contract.
It's a stupid contract, Desi.
I don't know. I think that really what you have here, and again, it's 3 years, so it's not, they haven't gone crazy, right? 3 years is reasonable for a 25-year-old goaltender, but Steve Mason has been good this year. We've had Anthony Sanfilippo on the show several times already this year, and he's talked about how good he's been, and when I've watched Steve Mason, he's been very good. His numbers are good this year. His numbers are a lot better than they were the last couple of years with the Columbus Blue Jackets, so they don't want to go into the offseason not knowing what their goaltending situation is going to be like. Will Ray Emery be back next year? That's debatable, but at least they know that Steve Mason is going to be back
except
next
they were,
year. I have no problem with the
except
contract.
Except they know that Steve Mason was going to be back next year because he wasn't an unrestricted free agent. He was an RFA coming into this offseason.
Right, but they didn't want to wait until that time to sign him, and they know what they have right now. He's 25 years old. He's been playing well this year. He's played 38 games, and they like how he's fit into the team and the way he's played, and they've signed him. Now, I guess a couple of years from now, we'll be debating whether that was a good contract, but 3 years, it's not 6 years, so
What if he reverts back to the goalie he was in Columbus, and they're paying Brizgalov, and then they're paying Mason, and both of them can't stop a beach ball?
It's possible. We know money isn't an object in Philly, but...
But the cap makes it an object, though. Back in the old days, okay, whatever. They could do what they want. I wouldn't care.
Sure, the Rangers spent $400 million and never won a game, but who cared?
True test of time is definitely going to be, can he keep performing at that level this year and obviously 3 years after, but... I think they're taking a bit of a blind leap of faith for sure because he struggled. And
why?
Paul Holmgren has to answer that question, but as far as Steve Mason is concerned, he didn't exactly have the best defense in front of him, so you can't just look at numbers. But is it a little bit too much money? Could you have paid him a little bit less maybe? Yes, but it's the Philly Flyers. And as you said, you don't know what to expect from the Philly Flyers. They might give the guy a little bit more.
And his agent came out and said he should make Carey Price money. That was probably funny. That's funnier than the contract, but both of them are hilarious.
Yeah, exactly right. The final signing from earlier this week was Matt Stajan, and he re-signs in Calgary. It's a 4-year, $12.5 million deal for Stajan, cap hit of $3.125 million per season. He had been making a cap hit of $3.5 million per year. This is just Calgary sort of needing a... He's a veteran guy. He knows how to play in the NHL. So sort of somebody to guide their young players.
They need somebody to play on the team. Have you seen that? Did you see the roster the Jets beat last week?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's almost that nobody's going to go there. So,
I don't mind it being a center. Can play against other guys, tough guys in the past. Players with some skill. He can add a little bit offensively. He's, good in the room. He's a nice guy. You need to have players. I don't have an issue. They got to spend money on somebody.
Yeah, I like that signing. He's 30 years old. It's funny that Brian Burke traded him for Dion Phaneuf, and now he's signing him. There's a little bit of irony there.
He was
joking that he wasn't going to let him walk in the free agent market after trading him for Phaneuf, even though Daryl Sutter insisted on him being part of the deal. So I like the signing. He's an underrated defensive forward, actually.
Yep.
At this point in his career, he's probably a 35, 40-point guy. But Sean Monahan, Sven Barchi, Backlund, a lot of that group of young players, they need a veteran there to kind of guide them, and he's being rewarded, and he's, you know, wears an A on his chest, so I like the signing.
Nobody's signing us to that money, unfortunately, but maybe we can tell Paul Holmgren we played goaltender once in rec league or something. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 2 hours down, 1 hour to go. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. The podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Winnipeg Jets game day here on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. The Jets and the Leafs, 6 p.m. puck drop at MTS Center, a game you can hear live at TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from ESPNChicago.com, Scott Powers. Scott, good afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Scott, you know, you look at the Blackhawks team, and to no one's surprise, really, they're towards the top of the NHL. They're the leading team in the Central Division right now. Now, the last time the Blackhawks won the Cup, that was in 09-10. That was also an Olympic season. Do you think that the Blackhawks may be better suited or more aware of what goes into winning the Stanley Cup during an Olympic season than some of their competitors because they did so 4 years ago, winning in an Olympic year?
They like to think so. I don't know. I think every time is different. It's interesting who the players are. You know, I think you have some older guys like Michael Hanzus and Marian Hossa going. I think you worry a little bit more about those guys that coming out. Even a guy like Michael Roosevelt, who, I think, you know, those guys are the ones that you got to worry about coming out of the break. And I think that sort of impact would be on any team, you know, Taves and Kane. I think all those guys withstand, a full season in the Olympics. And but I think the Blackhawks' main concern is those older guys and guys that are, they don't have the same sort of depth, at least I think, as the forwards as they did last year, where, Hanzus has been in the lineup every day, and, you know, at least with the defensemen, they've been able to, you know, they've been using eights this year and kind of rotating, and you can kind of give Roosevelt and some of those guys days off. So I'm curious if maybe they call, you know, recall some guys after the break, and, Hossa's back's withheld pretty well since the beginning of the season, and Hanzus has done pretty well. But I think after the break, those guys are going to need some, you know, some time off, and the Blackhawks got to be focused that, you know, they put themselves in a good position that, I think they'll be battling for that top seed again, whether it's in the division or in the conference altogether. But, just being careful that those guys coming out of the break, that they're healthy and, you know, can kind of make their final push.
Scott, earlier this week we found out that prior to being named team captain, Sidney Crosby called Jonathan Taves and he told him that he was going to be named captain. Jonathan Taves was going to be named assistant captain. What did it mean to Jonathan Taves for Sidney Crosby to tell him that he was going to do that, telling that prior to Hockey Canada making that announcement?
Yeah, I think Taves was nice. He felt like, he thought it was just, something that was nice and courteous. And, he didn't make a big deal out of it. But Taves, I'm sure that he would have loved to be captain. But I think for him to have any sort of letter, it's a huge recognition. Jonathan says a lot of the right things and often, does the right things too. And I think that's the one thing that's impressive about him is that I'm sure there's some disappointment. I'm sure that anyone would want to be captain. But, he said everything that, that you'd expect a leader and a captain to say, that how he feels honored to have an A and how, there's a lot of players on that team that are leaders and captain material. And so I think he was touched in a way. But he didn't make a big deal of it either way. I think he's excited to be, have a different role on this team than he did back in 2010 and have more of a, leadership role and maybe one of the older veterans now.
Scott, one of the guys going to be joining him in Sochi is Duncan Keith, and he missed last game with the flu. Are Jets fans going to see him tomorrow night in Chicago?
Yeah, they didn't. He didn't practice today, but Quinville said that he will play tomorrow. Today's practice was kind of weird. They all wore different kind of jerseys, colored jerseys, from green to white to blue to black, and they just played three-on-three scrimmage the whole practice, basically, and had a lot of fun with it and not really structured. You know, got a lot of guys cherry-picking and, you know, kind of made the competition really fun. And, you know, Quinville said he almost even considered taking today off. So I don't know. You know, he's done this occasionally over the last few years. Just maybe the guys are a little bit tight. And, you know, they've kind of had some ups and downs throughout January after, you know, after the winter break. And, you know, I think this is the sort of thing that you thought maybe they needed. It was just, you know, something to relax them a little bit and loose. And they're not even going to have a morning skate tomorrow. So, you know, with a 6 o'clock game, they've sometimes taken it off. But this season, they've mostly skated at with the earlier skate or the earlier time still. So I think that he feels like, you know, maybe right now, you know, one more home game and then they hit the road for 7 straight before the Olympic break. That maybe just it needs to be a little bit more loose right now.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Scott Powers of ESPNChicago.com talking about tomorrow night's Jets-Blackhawks game in Chicago. Scott, how disappointed, going back to the defense and going back to the Olympics, how disappointed was Blackhawks defenseman Brent Seabrook in not making the Canadian Olympic team?
Yeah, he's another one that didn't really voice a lot of disappointment, but you imagine he has to. It has to be there for him, you know, especially being part of the 2010 team. You know, he said sort of the right things too, you know, saying that he realizes there's a lot of people to be picked, and that, you know, a lot of guys that are very capable of filling that position, and he was happy to be considered. But you know, I think that he's also, I think for some of the guys that weren't picked, I know Crawford and Seabrook thought they should have been considered, and it might be some motivation. Even a guy like Brandon Saad, who you know, was kind of in the bubble for the American team, and maybe use that to propel them a little bit. But and no one was openly, you know, critical and upset about it. But I imagine at some level it has to irritate them a little bit.
Scott, the Hawks have kind of had a second line center opening for essentially all their past 5 contending years. Andrew Shaw is a guy who's playing there now. You hear word that they'd like to add a centerman, although obviously based on their past success, they don't need one. What do you think is going to happen there?
Yeah, I'm curious. You know, the cap situation isn't great for them right now. You know, Shaw's been capable, and that line's been better. You know, him and Saad and Kane seem like they've clicked a little bit. And you know, I think one thing for Kane is just finding more shooting opportunities. You know, he finally got back on the board the other day against Minnesota, but you know, gone I think 10 games without a goal. So as well as that line of playing, Kane really hadn't been finding his spot. So maybe that gets him going. And Shaw and Saad, it seemed like they pretty well both getting the net and, you know, being aggressive and just kind of the line's been moving a little bit faster. You know, with Hanzus there, the pace wasn't as much as it is now. So I think, you know, Quinville likes to obviously stick with what's working, and right now that's that. Down the line, I don't know. You know, Brandon Perry, who's in the American League, was pretty good at its spot until he was moved to the third line, and then you know, his defense was more needed, and that kind of exposed, and he went back to the American League, and, you know, he was pretty good with Kane there, and, you know, Hanzus did pretty well during the playoffs last year. You know, he was a little bit more fresh, so I don't know if they go back to that, but, and the other option is, you know, Teuvo Teravainen is a kid who's playing in Finland now, and kind of just, they tore it up in the World Junior Championships, and, you know, he's eligible to come over in April, and he played pretty well with the team. You know, he played a couple preseason games, and I think he's the second line of the future. I don't know if it's this year or he'll definitely be with the team next year, I think. So I think there's some different options. And maybe with Teravainen too, about might be about need. You know, if that position is still open, maybe they bring him over and give him a shot the last, you know, 6-7 games and see if it works in the playoffs. But I think for now they're content with Shaw and they're liking what they're getting from that line.
Scott, we asked you about Jonathan Toews earlier as far as the Olympics go, and we also wanted to ask you about Patrick Sharp, who was obviously named to his first Olympics, and there's a chance that he will actually play with Jonathan Toews on a line, and I think you'd agree that it was much deserved that he was named to the Olympic team. He's at a point-per-game clip right now. If things continue the way they have, he will set career marks for points. He might pass that 80-point line for the first time in the season. To you, what's different about this year? Why is he putting up better numbers than he has in the past? Because he's always been a consistent player in the NHL. He's had very many good years, but was the chance of playing in the Olympics extra motivation? What have you seen, I guess, differently about Sharp this year that is responsible for him putting up better numbers?
Yeah, I think there has to be some element for the Olympics. You know, obviously he was motivated, and that's something that it's been on his mind and something that's been driving him. You know, his ability as a shooter, you know, he gets a lot of shots on net. And, you know, him and Hossa and Taves have, they've just clicked. And, you know, it's the one line that's really been together all season. And they all seem to take turns. You know, one week it's Taves, the next week it's Hossa and Sharp. And Sharp's been pretty consistent. But that line, just it's been so good all season. And really, you know, Sharp even last season kind of played with Kane and, you know, on that second line. And I think, you know, playing with those guys, and it's opened up his game a little bit. And he's also getting a lot of shots on net. You know, he's really letting, you know, just, you know, shots from angles where you may not expect to score, that putting on there and just trying it. You know, I think the power play success, too. You know, the Blackhawks were so bad in the power play last year and so inconsistent that, you know, they found some, you know, something that worked this year. And I think him and Kane have both benefited from that. And so I think there's some different elements, but I think it's Sharp's consistency, like you talked about, and just maybe just, you know, adding a notch to it, and he's been really good all year.
You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Scott Powers of ESPNChicago.com talking about the Blackhawks. Of course, the Blackhawks and the Jets tomorrow night in the Windy City.
Scott, you look at the roster, and you talked about Patrick Sharp, and we talked about the other players. Most of their top players have been great all year. One guy who's not their top player but was so great last year in the playoffs was Brian Bickle. He gets the contract after that success. I don't think people expected him to keep up that pace, but he only has 9 points this year. How has he struggled so much this season? 9 points in 39 games is probably as bad as anybody could have expected.
Yeah, it's you know, one element now is obviously he's coming off a knee injury, so I think that's some of it now. Prior to that, it's a little bit harder to explain. You know, he went through some stuff in the playoffs, but, you know, played through it and obviously excelled and was given a chance to play with Taves and Kane to begin the season and didn't really take advantage of it. So he kind of got bumped back down to that third line, and he had a little spurt there where he scored, I think it was 3 consecutive games, and it really looked like he was rolling and kind of hit a slump again and got injured. I don't know. It's with him, it's they often talk about confidence and, you know, him playing with it. And, you know, lately his Corsi numbers and him and Versteeg, their numbers have been pretty good, where they're getting a lot of shots on net and really not giving up much. But Quinville hasn't really shown any faith in them again. You know, their minutes, they're mostly like fourth line minutes. You know, the third and fourth line, it seemed like they switched a little bit, where Bickle's only getting 8 or 9, you know, even strength minutes, and even though his numbers are better. So, you know, maybe he's a guy that benefits from this break, too, and really gets his knee in place and gains some confidence. And I know that he talked about having the brace was an adjustment, but, he needs to get back on that same path, because I think what the Blackhawks made the Blackhawks so good last year was those four lines and having that possibility of anyone scoring it right now. You know, that depth really doesn't seem to be in place, where that fourth line's not going to give you much offensively, and you obviously can get a lot from the first two lines, but that third line with Versteeg and Bickle especially, they need to produce a little bit more, and, you know, it's been a little bit spotty, and part of it to do with minutes, but, you know, with Quinville, it's, you know, if you play well, it'll eventually reward you. So I think they can just continue to do what they're doing. Eventually, that time will come again, but right now it's hard too with that contract too. The expectations are just so much different. You know, he gets paid like a top six forward, and you know, and some people question the time, because, you know, you're basing on 23 games in the playoffs, and his regular season numbers were okay, but you know, he's paid like a guy that's, you know, expected to score 20 and 30 goals, and he just hasn't been able to live up to that so far.
Scott, there's lots of hockey to be played still. The Ducks and Hawks still have 29 games left to play here, and the Ducks are now first in the West, 5 points ahead of the Hawks. As far as the other teams in the Western Conference, because I think you'd agree, all of these teams are gunning for the Chicago Blackhawks. They know they're the team to beat if they want to eventually get to the Stanley Cup Finals and eventually win it all. As far as these other teams, I mentioned the Ducks, but as far as the Blues, again, who we know are gearing up to, they know that they have to beat the Hawks if they're going to take that next step. Do you think that these teams have taken enough steps to eventually beat the Blackhawks in the playoffs? Because as we know, that's what it's all about, and the regular season is only one thing, but when it comes down to it, are any of these teams going to be able to beat the Hawks, do you think?
Yeah, I would based on some of the results this year, I think the Blues have, they've taken it up another level. And Anaheim was obviously pretty good last season and wasn't able to kind of complete that off. But, I think some of those teams have, beating the Blackhawks during the regular season has to lead to some kind of confidence level. Even St. Louis now, if St. Louis overtakes Chicago in that central there and wins the division, all of a sudden, that's a second-round divisional matchup. Playing in St. Louis could be a big difference. And, I think that's key. And right now the Blackhawks haven't beat St. Louis, too, so there's got to be some of that in their minds, too. So I think an important factor is where Corey Crawford ends up going, too. You know, he was so consistent last season and so good in the playoffs. And he's been good at times this year, but also been, down, too. So I think that he needs to regain that form. And I think in the second half that you'll see Antti Raanta a little bit more. And, I'm trying to get Crawford some more rest and get him prepared for the playoffs because Crawford's numbers aren't the same as last year. The consistency level just isn't the same.
Scott, we'll let you go on this last question. You look around the league, and almost every team at some point in time suffers, an injury or two injuries to a relatively valuable member of the team. The Blackhawks have been remarkably healthy this season. The probably biggest injury occurred to who they hope to be their backup goalie, Nikolai Habibulin, and he's been out for the majority of the year. What do you attribute the lack of the Blackhawks' injuries to?
It seems lucky, I'm sure they prepare well and do all those things, but I'm sure a lot of teams do too. And it's just, obviously the Blackhawks in the past have lost Hossa and Taves, the various injuries, and they lost Crawford for a bit this year for a month, and even Bickle for a month. And I don't, not that I'm aware of, they do anything different than anyone else. I think some of it is just dumb luck and. The Nuggets are nice thing too. Obviously, they have the depth where they can probably absorb that. But from the standpoint of not having lost someone like a lot of teams, I don't think there's anything unique to what the Blackhawks are doing.
Scott Powers covers the Chicago Blackhawks for ESPNChicago.com. Scott, thanks very much for doing this afternoon.
I appreciate it. Anytime. Thank you.
Take care, Scott. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Past 2:00. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thank you to Scott Powers for just joining us to talk about the Blackhawks ahead of tomorrow's Jets-Blackhawks game. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca, and on our website, IllegalCurve.com. If you haven't yet, there's still time for you to submit your entries for tonight's Illegal Curve game-winning goal contest and the Illegal Curve 50-50 contest. Use hashtag ICGWG on Twitter or hashtag IC5050. You can win great Illegal Curve merchandise. Gentlemen, we've had this conversation on the show multiple times before regarding the NHL's point system and how, some games are worth 3 points and some games are worth 2 points. And there's an article, again, as it happens, by our friend Craig Custance, who speculated that some of the general managers in the NHL may be ready to move on to a new system where regulation wins. And this is what's been bandied about, and hockey fans have sort of been, or some of the hockey fans at least, have been clamoring for it, where a regulation win is worth 3 points. So you're really rewarding a team for going at it for it in the third period. Go ahead.
I just don't think it happens because we're all about, or the NHL is all about, Gary Bettman's all about parity, or at least the idea of parity. And the point is, if you have 3 points in these games, what team wins in overtime or shootout and the other team loses, you get 2 points for one team and one for the other. So that's why you're saying a three-point game, Drew, as opposed to a team-winning regulation, only 2 points are available.
Right.
Or only 2 points are awarded, excuse me. You won't have that happen, I just don't think, because the three-point game with Chicago, those teams will be so far ahead that it won't be interesting to the outside, to the fans. And you see in the article, Craig Custance is interviewing a general manager who says, it's unfair. I think it was somebody, I forget which team, that said it was unfair that they were chasing and they won. Florida beat Philly, I think it was. And the teams ahead of them, a team lost the shootout. So the two teams ahead of them both got points and they beat a team clean and only got 2 points. And they said that the point of the article was that, or one of the points of the article was that, you know, it's a false kind of perception that a team that far back, like a Florida, can make it because all these three-point games happen. So the fans are kind of being sold a bill of, but that's the point. The point is you want the teams to think that they can make it. You want the fans to think that their teams can make it. You want Winnipeg fans to think, well, it's possible that we can win, 10 games, 5 games in a row, and we still have a chance, and blah, blah, blah. So if you have the three-point game, and these good teams are cleaning out all the other, poor teams, and getting 3 points for a win, they're going to be 15, 20, 30 points ahead by the end of the season. And what will happen is there won't be many races. So even if it's a fake race or the race is something that really isn't what it seems to be, at the end of the day, that's what they want.
Right, and to elaborate on that point, Richie, I think in this article that Craig Custance wrote, that really is the most important part of that article. And it applies to the Winnipeg Jets as well, who are right now in 12th in the Western Conference, and who, let's say, if they beat the Toronto Maple Leafs and get 2 points, and then another team that they're chasing, let's say the Nashville Predators, get to overtime, they get the point but end up losing, they're not gaining any ground. And this is the point here, and there is the parity argument, but it really is the fairness argument. Too many games are going to shootouts. I think we'd all agree on that. At least I think so. I don't like the shootout. I like anything. As far as I'm concerned right now, I think that we should go back to the old system where you get 1 point for a tie, and you get 2 points for a win, and if you lose in overtime, you get nothing.
I'm totally with you. What was wrong
with that system that was there for how many years?
I liked it.
50 years, 60 years?
We
had that system.
I have no issue with the tie. You didn't win in 65 minutes.
Right.
Well, then too bad. I don't think the fans care. Well, maybe some of them do. I don't think the executives... I think the executives would prefer a tie to anything, to be honest with you.
I don't think it's preventing fans from buying tickets to the possibility
right.
that the game ends in a tie.
That's right. Now, look at... back. If you even give 3 points for a regulation or overtime win... the Jets would be not 10 points back of Minnesota right now. They'd be 14 points back of Minnesota. Essentially done.
Sure.
And the NHL does not want that, so it's not going to change.
It's right. interesting if you look at the Northeast or the Atlantic Division and the Toronto Maple Leafs, and we talked about the Leafs, they have the most shootout wins in the NHL. If you looked at that whole division and you gave 3 points to teams that won in regulation and the teams that either that won in or that had an overtime defeat got that 1 point, the Leafs would actually be in sixth place in that division as opposed to fourth place right now.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a huge difference right now. And, I mean, all these teams that are winning in regulation, there's no real reward for doing so.
Right. And this other aspect of this three-point system that we currently have is that teams are not maybe going as hard as they can in the overtime period so that they can get to the shootout. And that is an aspect here because the shootout is separate from the 4-on-4 overtime in the sense that your strategy is different. You go, okay, well, the overtime's almost going to be over. I think it makes the overtime less important, quite frankly, because you know that you've got the point. All you have to do is get to the shootout. And teams that are good at the shootout, Richie...
get to overtime to get the
right,
point.
To get
yeah.
the... Right. And so...
the last five minutes of a regulation game, as Drew always says, and he's right, you have no incentive because if you all you want to do is get a point. So if you go all out and try and get 2 points, why would you do that now when you can do that in 5 minutes and for sure get 1 point?
That's right. You just should. Everybody sort of plays very defensively and nobody takes any risks because, like you said, there is no incentive for going hard and winning in regulation versus winning in overtime. One thing I don't agree with, and I don't think it's going to change either, and because I think the NHL loves the parity, like you said.
I think there'd be parity without it, but okay.
The first tiebreaker in the when it comes to playoff positioning is regulation and overtime wins.
Yep.
I don't understand why it's not strictly just regulation wins. The game, I mean...
I agree with that, too.
Regulation and overtime, they're not the same hockey. 4-on-4 hockey is different from 5-on-5 hockey. So reward a team for winning in the 60 minutes, not the 65 minutes, when it's not the same game.
I agree with that. I think that's fair, because it is different. Now... getting to 3-on-3 is just another way of getting rid of the shootout. And if it's 3-on-3 or a shootout, I still want 3-on-3.
Yeah.
I really could do without both.
That's right. But, I mean, 3-on-3, they're both gimmicky, but 3-on-3 is going to be more fun than a shootout.
Well, it's less gimmicky because you're still passing.
That's right.
You'd have to hope that over the coming years, Craig Custance talked to Steve Yzerman, who's considered kind of one of the new school GMs, I guess, and he was saying that he didn't believe it was going to change. So there is the belief that nothing's going to change, but you have to believe... that over the coming years they're going to start to explore this, and they're going to look at everything. They're going to say 4-on-4 maybe for 10 minutes, maybe go to 3-on-3 for 5 minutes, maybe go to 4-on-4 for 20 minutes, maybe go to just stay at 5-on-5 for 10 minutes. These things, I think, are all better ways to end a game than a shootout. And again,
but the PA will be against anything more than 5 minutes of OT.
The PA will definitely be against it, Richie.
The PA will be against it, and when it comes to the 3 points and
the GMs will probably be against it.
Yeah, but when it comes to the 3 points, all Gary Bettman's going to do, the general managers can propose whatever they want. Gary Bettman's going to walk into the owners, and he's going to say, if you approve this, you know, Calgary, Edmonton, and really the bottom 10 teams in the league, you're going to be done in February, and you're going to have a hell of a hard time selling tickets.
That's one thing. The other thing is there's less of a problem in Calgary and Edmonton, Drew, than it is in Dallas and Colorado. But
sure.
The other thing you have to take into account, well, not other thing. If you're Gary Bettman, you want the races, as I was saying earlier. But this is how Gary Bettman is would determine on an ongoing basis the best point system. He's going to have his assistant, whoever it is, one of his many, put a spreadsheet together and see which point system makes it the closest.
That's right.
Makes there very little difference between third and tenth. And he will say, that is the best system for our game. Whether or not it rewards the best teams in the league, I don't care. The best teams will eventually come out at the end.
That's his
argument.
That's what Bethman will say.
Yes. And he'll say, but I want to see 3 and 10 with 5 points apart, because every team and every fan base will think that their team's got a shot.
That's right. And you're 12th place, you're only 3-4 points out, and I'm still going to buy tickets. That's
exactly right.
The unfortunate part is that's not the best way to determine the outcome of a hockey
game. They don't care.
But,
yeah. It's the best way to make money.
Yeah, it's the best way to make money, and that's all that matters to them. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. When we come back, we'll look around at some of the trade talk this week in the NHL.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. This segment of the show is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants of Manitoba. Certified General Accountants are not simply accountants anymore. They are entrepreneurs, CEOs, presidents, and partners. Quite simply, they are leaders in business. For more information on becoming a CGA, contact the CGA Association at cga-manitoba.org. Certified General Accountants, we see more than numbers. Gentlemen, we're entering the time in the NHL year where really every day there's new trade talk that comes up, trade rumors more than any sort of specifics. Teams are falling out of the playoff race, and they're looking to trade and revamp their lineup and improve, or just get rid of unrestricted free agents that aren't going to be around for much longer. The first name that's on the block, or I want to start in Edmonton. And we saw the Oilers here not that long ago.
Doesn't it always start with Edmonton? It seems like Edmonton, every week it starts with Edmonton.
It seems like it has, because they're a mess of an organization right now. And Dallas Eakins is out giving press conferences where he admits that his job potentially could be on the line. He's been the head coach there for about 2 weeks or something along those lines.
Drew, are the Oilers just going to have a different coach every year? Like, when are they going to just stick with a coach? Because they did sign him to a 4-year deal.
Yeah, but I mean, apparently that doesn't matter.
No, but I'm just saying, the amount of coaches they've had in the last 3 or 4 years is a little bit ridiculous.
It's absurd. I mean, the Oilers organization is quickly becoming one of the laughing stocks in the NHL about how bad it has been. And you hear the Oilers are shopping the names. You've heard the names before. Alex Hemsky, or Sam Gagne is available. Niall Yakupov, we've heard all year that he's talked about. Now there's talk that Jordan Eberle could potentially be on the market because he would fetch the most in return. If I'm the Edmonton Oilers and I'm looking at my roster, Jordan Eberle is one of the guys I'm not trading because he's a core component. He's a guy that you can win with in the NHL. But if Jordan Eberle is available, I mean, I think every 29 other teams in the NHL are certainly calling the Oilers up and trying to see what it's going to take to get him out of town.
Yeah, of course, Drew. I mean, they're probably floating it to see if they can get a franchise defenseman back, and they say, you know, okay, we'll trade you Jordan Eberle if you give us back, you know, a top young defenseman, probably. I like Jordan Eberle's game. I think he's a great player, so I wouldn't be dealing him, but they can get, you know, if they could get Jacob Trouba for him, Drew, as an example, they would do it, probably. I mean, if they can get a game-breaking defenseman, likely looks like he's going to be, for it, somebody like that, and you're going to probably do it. But it's only going to be a straight-up, probably one-for-one talent deal for a defenseman, not a forward, really. And that's the only way I see it. Either it's not going to be a package deal, Jordan Eberle, for a young defenseman, a prospect. It's not going to be anything like that. It's going to be for a top young defenseman in the NHL or nothing. And I just don't see him getting moved, really. They might trade their first-round pick this year, which, once again, will be very, very high, although it's a weak draft. Not a very deep draft. Not a very big draft, according to Craig Button, in terms of size of players. So that might be an issue, and maybe it is they packaged with a guy with Yakupov. So many of these guys are so young in town. It's not their fault that they haven't insulated them and provided them with enough talent on, you know, around them. So I wouldn't go trading those players because you haven't given them any defensemen or goaltending. It seems like it's just a mishmash there, and by trading a Yakupov before you really know what he is, that's a risky proposition. So it seems like it's a nameless organization that continues to lack aim, although McTavish in his move so far, you know, that hasn't been that, but the Perron trade was a great trade. It's been a really good player for them. He's leading them in goals. So there has been good things from McTavish. We just haven't seen enough from him. It's still hard to predict. Both Kevin Lowe at the top in Edmonton, you always assume it's going to be a bad deal based on the past few years.
Yeah, there's now a movement in Edmonton called the Lowe Must Go movement, where the fans are demanding that Kevin Lowe no longer be a part of the Oilers front office. So things are, I mean, the fans in Edmonton, I think rightfully so, are getting fed up with this just year after year of futility, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, they're struggling. I don't think for any second that they're interested in trading Eberle unless they get a number one defenseman, as Richie said. I think Eberle, to me, on that team is one of the untouchable pieces, along with Taylor Hall, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, probably Justin Schultz you could throw in there. I don't think Yakupov is necessarily untouchable, but he's close to being untouchable. But Richie mentioned it. I don't think that they're interested in trading a guy who they view as a huge part of the core going forward. It's almost like they're running out of names. Is Alex Hemsky probably going to move? Yes, because they're not going to make the playoffs, and he doesn't factor into that. Is Sam Gagne going to move? I'm not sure about that. He also is young, and he factors in possibly to the core of that team, and he's under contract. So I think Jordan Eberle, to me, I heard about that, and I thought it's a little bit ridiculous. It doesn't mean that if they're not offered, as Richie said, a really good player, they wouldn't entertain that offer. But Jordan Eberle is a bona fide first-line winger, and at 23 years old, you could argue that his best years are to come. So I we're going to be talking about this for the next 6 weeks leading up to the trade deadline, but I don't think you could definitely say with certainty that Eberle is one of those guys that you should even really have your eye on as far as moving. Hemsky and other players maybe more so, but not Eberle. He's a big part of that future.
In Boston, moving to Boston, when they lost Dennis Seidenberg to the knee injury, people said, okay, that's a hole you're going to have to fill because they have good young players there, but it's hard. You know, you want to fill Dennis Seidenberg because Boston's a team that has designs on getting back to the Stanley Cup Finals.
You have to fill that spot.
Yeah, and there's a lot of names that are being bandied about now. Some of the names, you know, talked about this week. Chris Phillips out of Ottawa, if the Senators continue to struggle. Mm-hmm. Andrew McDonald, the Islanders defenseman, who's going to be an unrestricted free agent at the end of this year, supposedly wants a $5 million contract wherever he signs in the offseason. Kyle Quincy out of Detroit, as the Red Wings continue to struggle.
Yeah, Kyle Quincy's not a good option for them.
Okay, well, let's start there. Why isn't Kyle Quincy a good option?
Well, he's not good enough to play top 4 minutes on a contending team. Just not good enough. I know he's played every game for Detroit this year, and I know, you know, he can move the puck and skate, but he's not a guy you're going to put in your top four and try and be a contending team to win at all. Chris Phillips, I mean, doesn't skate as well as Dennis Seidenberg. Yeah, he's a great heart and soul guy. He'd fit into that team, but they probably want him to play a little bit of a lesser role if they have designed, you know, optimally. In terms of the second player you mentioned, Andrew McDonald, he can log big. No, he's not a big guy, but he can log big minutes. He can skate. So he's the guy I think would make the most sense there. But the Islanders want to keep a guy like that, right? I know Calvin DeHaan's played better here, and they have Hamonic locked up long term. They have Griffin Reinhart through the system, but you want to get a guy like McDonald who can log big minutes locked up. And if you can't, then it makes sense to trade him. Why, for example, they give all the money to Vanek and maybe not to McDonald, if so long as their requests are reasonable, doesn't really make sense to me long term. But whatever. McDonald makes the most sense there, but he would probably cost you at least a first-round pick. And hey, I think Boston would. And something else, I think Boston probably, that could be a match.
And the other name that they also bandied about, Henrik Talander out of Buffalo.
He can't skate well enough either. I don't think either. I think it's McDonald out of those four.
Is he?
out of those four, probably, yeah, Talander was struggling in New Jersey, and then after going over to Buffalo, he's clearly not the defenseman that he once was. So if you're talking about Talander on the Boston Bruins, most likely he's a bottom-pairing defenseman. Andrew McDonald is an interesting choice because he is a perennial shot-blocking leader for the New York Islanders. He arguably is their number one defenseman. And when you look at what is the goal there as far as signing him, is it a rent-a-player situation, or is the hopes to sign him? And that kind of determines what the Boston Bruins will offer for Andrew McDonald. So I'd have to agree. Chris Phillips, I think, can add a lot to a team, more so probably in a bottom-pairing role. But absolutely, if you can add a guy like that, he kind of plays a similar role in the sense that Dennis Seidenberg is a physical defenseman. Chris Phillips is limited offensively. He always has been. But he's a very sound defensive defenseman. So
yeah, that's right.
Don't have a problem with acquiring Phillips, but I guess you're trying to fill a void there via trade. So you're probably going to give up some draft picks or a prospect. So it'll be interesting to see what the Bruins do, because the Bruins, again, pretty sound roster, and they've made a few moves, but really they're again a team to beat along with the Penguins in the East.
Last player I want to talk about is David Legwand out of Nashville. We'll see him here on Tuesday for the Predators. Unrestricted free agent at the end of this year. He's played his entire career in Nashville. You know, he's making $4.5 million this season, but we're almost towards the end of the year, so the cap hit is less important, of course. You know, where would Legwand be a match, and do you expect him to go?
Be a great match in Chicago, cap-wise, but I mean, that's intra-division. He would add speed on that line. He can play defensively. I mean, he'd be great for that second line spot. But David Legwand's a guy, Drew, who probably, as he probably agreed with, fits in most places. I mean, he's never been the offensive dynamo they thought he'd be, drafted out of Plymouth, I believe. But he's been a guy who's responsible defensively. He can skate. He's been kind of through battles. He has 35 points this year. So Chicago would be one team that would make sense. You wonder the other teams, like a team like Montreal, do they want to add a little bit more size, and they can already skate, but a little bit more size, a veteran influence, a guy who can log some minutes? That would be a place also where I think it makes some sense.
Yeah, Montreal works, and there are a lot of teams that are looking for a guy like David Legwand, and we don't know if what the future holds for him in Nashville, because there is a lot of things to like about the Nashville Predators. They just made a trade for Michael Delzotto, obviously, but there are a lot of good young players there. Philip Forsberg is another guy that was good at the World Junior Tournament. And so if David Legwand kind of I think the conversation with David Poile would probably be a pretty interesting one, as far as, do you want to go win it this year? Because David Legwand, doesn't have only 1 year left in the NHL, but he's got a limited amount of years left in the NHL, and he has to be thinking, okay, well, are the Predators a playoff team next year? He's also a guy that has a lot of playoff experience. But yeah, Montreal works, and, you know, I look at another team that could maybe use him, in the New Jersey Devils, who right now are having trouble scoring goals, and he could fit in there. I think he would fit in nicely to
Pete
DeBoer's system. Yeah. Legwand to New Jersey, so let's start those rumors up.
You just did. Let's go to break. When we come back, one final segment. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live at Boston Pizza City Place on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast, on TSN1290.ca.
That night we went down to the river.
I just got it. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290.
Take us down to the river, Drew.
We need to explain why this song is so fitting. That's, of course, because Drew is eating dinner on the river next week.
You can make fun of me next Saturday as well for that. I'm not the only person, for the record.
It's the second time you've ate dinner on the river, right?
Yeah, it's a big thing. You guys are missing out. It's a lot of fun. We're talking about the ice restaurant that they're building at the Forks again. It's going to be terrific. So my wife and I are heading
down
there.
When you put your hand into the water and grab that fresh fish. So it's going to be the best river meal you've ever had.
So how do you get there? Do you snowshoe there? You don't just...
No, a dog sled. We're strapping Brixton, my dog, up to a sled, and she's gonna mush down to the Forks. That seems totally reasonable, right? Anyways, one final segment on this Saturday afternoon here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Following us, Hustler and Lawless here on TSN 1290. Gary's going to be as away, but Troy Westwood, looking dapper at the bar as per usual, is going to be joining Hustler for 2 hours of Hockey Talk.
Hold on, hold on. I give out the compliments to Troy.
Yeah, chill.
You don't want to just have everybody on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show giving compliments to Troy.
They won't mean as much then.
I'll handle the compliments.
You said the weather was fine earlier, so I mean, I'm not so sure I can trust what you have to say.
I'll tell you what. I'll give both of you guys credit. You're both playing injured, playing sick this afternoon, and you made it through. You made it through pretty well.
No, thank you, Drew. I thought you put together a nice plan today.
Thank you.
Cortisone's a hell of a drug.
The keys to the game, Jets and the Leafs, 6 p.m. puck drop, of course, here on TSN 1290. Your key to the game, your prediction, what do you guys expect to see happen tonight?
I expect it to be a great game, guys, and I think everybody is. Anytime the Leafs are in town, it seems to be awesome. They were here the first season on New Year's Eve, but I think one of the big keys is shutting down that top line for the Jets. And I think Zach Bogosian has done an excellent job since his minutes have increased, Dustin Byfuglien moving to forward. So shutting down that top line is important. And I think the Jets really do have to stick to that game plan that they have been sticking to over the last five games here and not really getting back to those old habits that they had previously under Claude Noel that unfortunately cost him his job, and it was really inconsistent defensive play. But against the Toronto Maple Leafs, you got to stay out of the penalty box. They've got an excellent power play. I think also you got to stick to what's made them successful against the Ducks and the Sharks on that Western Conference, that quick California swing. That's playing physical, because this defense isn't as mobile. We talked about how they've had trouble breaking out of their zone. They've had trouble moving the puck, and they're one of the weaker teams right now. They're fragile. So I think, you know, be physical on these guys, and that's where having a guy like Dustin Byfuglien on the third line there not only adds offensively, but it adds to the forechecking game. So I think those are my keys, and I think the Jets are going to win this game. I think they're motivated after that loss. They're playing really well. I'll say 3-2 Jets.
Yeah, I think, as I said earlier, Drew, I know it's a little bit later on the show, different audience, and so it's a speed element. It's a speed game. Today's game is one that there's certainly no lack of speed on either side. And I think the Jets need to use that to their advantage, of course, in the sense of pressuring the Leafs and their defense that can at times be quite porous defensively. Of course, they've allowed 36 shots on goal per game, and many times it's exceeded 40. That's how you get such a high average. But in terms of defending, if you're the Jets, you have to be able to, you know, you hear the coach speak, but it's true in this sense. It's called managing the puck. Making sure you don't try crazy cross-ice passes against a great transition team like Toronto with the speed and quickness that they have, and guys who can rip it off the rush like Kessel. Kadri can rip it off the rush. Van Riemsdyk. Guys like even Lupo. All those guys can shoot the puck, and so you don't want to turn the puck over and give them easy opportunities. So if you're able to get the puck in deep and take away their speed and get bodies on them early in the neutral zone, I think the Jets can win this game. And I think the Jets will win this game. And I think this is a matchup. If you look at the rosters, I think the Jets are arguably, based on the two rosters they have today, especially without Boland and Clarkson, I think the Jets are the better team. And I think they win tonight 4-3.
The key to me is for the Jets, all the things you mentioned certainly would factor into it. I think the Jets can take advantage of the bottom six of the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Their
bottom two forward lines.
Absolutely.
You look at nothing about that I find to be scary. I mean, you're talking guys. Mason Raymond, who I thought actually is a guy the Jets should have had interest in the offseason, has had a good year for the Toronto Maple Leafs. But I think that the Jets' third line of, you know, Jokinen, Setoguchi, and Byfuglien, if they're matched up against that third line of forwards or that fourth line of forwards, and at some point in the game you would expect that the Jets will get advantageous matchups, especially with the last change.
Absolutely right.
I think that they
would. Very good point.
That's certainly an area that the Jets can take advantage of, and I think that, you know, the Leafs are in a playoff spot, but I think that's more of a function of being in a weaker conference and a little bit of smoke and mirrors than them being a really terrific hockey team. And you look at them, and they've had great goaltending all year, but tonight I think the Jets are going to keep, you know, they're going to keep, I know they lost on Thursday, so it's not a streak per se, but a streak of well-played games that they've had over the last couple weeks. I think that continues, and I don't think it's as close. I think the Jets beat the Leafs tonight 4-1. I think they're able to handle the Leafs. The Leafs, to me, seem to be very much built on confidence, and I think they might be questioning themselves after what happened to them on Thursday night.
I don't know about that, Drew.
Well,
We'll see.
We put our names to our predictions again, so we can at least hold each other accountable
on Wednesday.
And that's why our reputations are tarnished. Just kidding.
Yeah, tarnished indicates that they were actually good at one point in time. I think just bad from the get-go.
Richie has a good reputation.
That's true.
Drew, me and you, not so much.
No, not so much at all.
Well, you walked into the women's washroom earlier.
That's true. Third time you threw him under the bus today. So
thanks
well done
that.
On that.
Thanks for that.
Let's finish the show off. Let's do cheers and jeers.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And jeers.
No, not good enough.
He's a bad boy.
I never seen something stinks like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Richard Pollock.
People in the city, and we've been critical of him in the past as well, like to take aim at Evander Kane for certain things that he's done. But I was at Game Day Skate today. There's a couple of little kids there with their parents. I guess they got access however they did. And while the Jets were walking off the ice at Game Day Skate, they were all signing autographs. And I thought, obviously, it was a nice touch. And the guys were all, everybody signed. They were all great. But Evander Kane not only signed, but he gave the kid his stick. And he didn't have to give him his stick. And when he was using it in practice, and he gave him the stick, and I thought, you know, we should. That's something that's a nice thing. It shows that a good quality, and we don't give. You know, if we're gonna criticize him, then we should at least give him credit where I think credit's due. And I thought that was a nice gesture on his part, and I want to give him a cheer.
Hold on, how is he gonna play if he doesn't have a stick? No,
that's a good point. Yeah, I know. I think he's actually playing with a goalie stick tonight.
I thought the kid's gonna play for him.
Good on Kaner for doing that.
Yeah. I'm gonna Leafs fans.
Yeah, I'm gonna quickly give my cheer here. Erik Nystrom scored 4 goals yesterday, and they lost. First time in his career he's ever scored 4 goals. I'm going to give him a cheer because he's had a tough year, and it's good for him to have those 4 goals.
He's a good player.
And give him a cheer just because he scored 4 goals and you lose the game. So I'm going to give him a cheer.
Well,
they got a point. But
they got a point. They lost in a shootout.
Yeah.
Barry Trotz didn't use him in the shootout either.
Exactly.
That's worth noting.
Even more reason to give him the cheer.
Yeah, exactly right. I'll wrap up cheers and jeers. I'm going to cheer the St. Louis Blues. They're out east on an East Coast road trip, and they changed around their schedule, and they all trekked to Yale University, where it was white out for Mandy night, that being Mandy Schwartz,
the sister of Jaden Schwartz
of the St. Louis Blues. So they went there. They held a practice at Yale, and they sort of went the extra mile for their teammates.
That's a great cause.
For their teammates. Yeah. Sister who passed away from leukemia.
Yep.
So kudos to the St. Louis Blues. Kudos to the University of Yale and everything else for keeping that good. That's just a good thing for a team to do. So well done
for
them. That's it for this Saturday afternoon in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. A big thank you to our guests, Michael Trakos of National Post, Scott Powers from ESPNChicago.com, and of course Kyle Kozier and Tom Lynn from Veritas Hockey, who joined us down here at Boston Pizza. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba, and the Linden Market Dental Center. In case you missed any of the show, it will be available for download on iTunes, on tsn1290.ca, and on our website, illegalcurve.com. You can follow us on Twitter, @IllegalCurve, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and the website for your latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is illegalcurve.com. Wednesday evening, NHL Midweek on TSN 1290, 6 p.m. For my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, for producer Chris, for producer Tim back at the station, and producer Remus, thanks very much for listening. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Hustler and Lawless are next.
You've been listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.